Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at food farming in our environmental world, Also broadcast on Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM, on the eastern shore of Maryland. We begin our program today with Nathaniel Johnson. He joins us once again. He's a food writer at Grist, one of our favorite journals. Teaches at the Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, in the Graduate School of Journalism. He was the author, when he joined us before, when he talked about his book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and Environmental Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. Here to talk about his latest article on Grist, If Berkeley Can't Pass a Soda Tax, Who Can? Nathaniel, welcome back.
Good morning.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Talk to us here, talk@steinershow.org. By email, tweet me at Mark Steiner, or log on to our Facebook page. It's 410-319-8888. So Nathaniel, I love the title of the piece, and I was reminded reading this article about a mayoral debate here in Baltimore that I moderated in the last election. And one of the candidates said, "We need to tax sodas and potato chips to lead toward healthier eating and more revenue for the city," and almost to a person, the audience screamed and yelled, "No, no, 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 no." I'll never forget that moment. And because many working people just don't like this idea at all.
Absolutely. There's a reason that, obesity is associated strongly with lower incomes. Those are the foods that make rational sense for you to buy if you don't have a lot of money, most calories for your buck. So it is absolutely a regressive tax.
On the other hand, there's a huge movement in places like Berkeley and San Francisco to have this pass that you were covering. And I think it's interesting to talk about the political dynamic that's taking place in Berkeley right now.
Well, in Berkeley, there's a huge amount of support for this idea of a soda tax, and just among the locals. And I think that support comes from this kind of basic idea that we know that soda and sugar sweetened beverages in general are a big contributor to obesity, and it kind of makes sense to try and depress the amount of soda that people drink by taxing it, and to raise money that could be used to make improvements and programs that could help with obesity for the city. I was biking around town trying to get a picture of a no on the tax sign, one of these lawn signs. And there's tons of yes signs, but it's really hard to find a no sign. On the other hand, you have the businesses and the soda companies funding a really strong campaign, people going door to door, people making phone calls to push against it. And they say at least that they're getting some traction, that the numbers are moving in the right direction.
One of the things I find interesting is that you do quote the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, in your article, who lives in Berkeley, and he had a push poll, which are very popular, classic kind of political move, partisan campaigns to kind of push your vote in a certain direction. But he got this call, and he said, "Who's financing the survey? Americans for Food or Beverage Choice," the person who called him answered. "Who's financing the group? The American Beverage Association." And then it deteriorated from there. The guy hung up, but he knew the answer, Pepsi and Coke. And here's the problem. I mean, so it's one of these situations where that the large businesses that really are selling us food that is inherently bad for us, that we love and are addicted to, many people are. I grew up as a Coca-Cola kid. There's a Pepsi kids and Coca-Cola kids. I was a Coca-Cola kid, right? And so we had it in our house all the time, and we loved Coca-Cola. My father drank it all the time. What it's doing to us. So on one hand, you want to oppose them because of what they're doing to society. On the other hand, people are kind of unenamored and angry about it because of the notion of taxing. And how to address this issue, I think, is really the crux of the issue here.
Right. Well, what I said in my article, and as I was thinking through it, is, sugar sweetened beverages, sodas, are really, it's kind of inexcusable. It's a comfort food perhaps, but it's not something that you're getting any kind of nutrition from
None.
other than the sugar. You're getting the calories that will help you, give you a little energy maybe, but man, oh man, you pay a high price for that in health, not to mention in cash. And and what the studies have shown is that people, when the prices go up, people tend to move to other things, and they, often it's not super healthy things. If they want the comfort food, they're gonna, get a fatty slice of pizza instead rather than Coke. But even a fatty slice of pizza is going to be way better than a can of Coke.
I had my youngest daughter's mother, and I hear your stories out there, 410-319-8888. What do you think about the idea of taxing sodas in whether it's Berkeley, California or Baltimore, Maryland? What are your thoughts at 410-319-8888? You can write to us here at talk at steinershow.org. And she did an experiment where she poured Coca-Cola in a toilet at night, left it sitting there all night long, and it ate away all of the stains in the toilet. I mean, and you hear these stories ad nauseum about what Coke does when you just leave it overnight, put a piece, how it deteriorates metal and the rest. And, they're pushing this stuff on us. That's the obscenity to me.
Yeah, I'm less worried about the corrosive qualities of it. I've heard those stories too. Then, I mean, just the sugar, the massive
Right,
amount of
right.
calories, because we can really see the health effects of that. And it's advertised to kids, with cartoon polar bears and all the rest.
So tell us what politically you think this is, and what's going to happen there. But also, you also kind of surveyed other places around the country where a certain level of taxing on sodas has actually helped.
Right. Well, that's the question. Has it helped? I mean, the interesting thing is when I'd heard about soda taxes before, it had always been talked about in such a way that, like, this is the first, let should we do this? This is the first time that anybody's ever tried this. And they're come to find out that, Tennessee did it back in the 30s, and Arkansas tried it, and Arkansas still has a soda tax. Ohio tried it for a few years. So all these different states have instituted it, but they've done it at much lower levels. Taxation has to be high enough, has to be up to a certain level before people change their habits. So if
Right.
you're talking about a gas tax, if you raise the gas tax a few cents, people are going to grumble, but they're still going to drive. If you talk about doubling or tripling it, all of a sudden people are saying, "Oh, let's talk about having a real public transportation network. Let's show me that bus route again." The same is true with soda taxes. When and this is about a 20% tax on soda, and that's the level where they really started to see people making
20%.
behavioral changes.
So tell me what your analysis of where you think it's going.
In terms of the likelihood of it passing, I think it'll pass in Berkeley. It requires a simple majority here, and the polls so far have shown that the people basically support it. There's a clear majority in the polls that say this is a great thing, and then the people who oppose it, it's like 20-30% of people who really feel strongly about opposing it.
But San
So,
Francisco's different, I take it.
right. In San Francisco, it requires a two-thirds majority, and support is a little bit more tepid there. So I don't think it'll pass in San Francisco, but I think it has a real good chance of passing in Berkeley, and it'll be a really interesting experiment to see how it works out.
And is this on November the 4th?
On election day.
So after Election Day, we'll talk to you again. I'm curious to see how this turns out. And I'm going to tell you, Nathaniel Johnson, we do love Grist. I think it's a great online place, and it's important for us to kind of stay on top of what's in Grist. And I appreciate your skeptic's mind and what you bring to the table.
Thanks so much.
So we'll be linking to the article, If Berkeley Can't Pass a Soda Tax, Who Can?, as well as to Nathaniel Johnson's other work and his book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest. So Nathaniel Johnson, thank you so much once again for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Always a pleasure. Thank you. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about what is becoming a huge battle in the state of Maryland over this phosphorus management tool that was supposed to be implemented, was put off by the governor, be put into a study on the economic impact. There are all kinds of questions about that study, and nobody's seen, even though it's gone off for expert opinion. We'll come back with our guests to talk about that in a minute. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and to Soundbites here. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Money comes back in the end. For more information, www.mecu.com, or its banner is at SteinerShow.org, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. We are here now with our three guests as we examine what is happening with this phosphorus management tool. It was supposed to go into effect a year ago when an agreement was reached, but then the governor sent it back for study to the Purdue School of Business at Sorbonne University to look at its effect on the agricultural industry. Now, the phosphorus management tool was a tool that was going to be used to measure the amount of phosphorus on land used in the farming communities that would measure what's going into the bay and whether or not more could be laid on and other restrictions that would apply. And many in the agriculture industry said that this would cause a financial hardship, economic problems with it. So there are lots of questions going on. We are joined here by Robin Broder, who is Waterkeeper Chesapeake board member. Let me get my other paper here. I'm so sorry. Tim Wheeler, who is reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog. Kevin Anderson, president of the Maryland Grain Producers Association, a grain farmer at Wimberley Farms in Princess Anne, Maryland. Scott Edwards, co-director of Food and Water Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. Good to have all three of you with us once again. Welcome.
Thank you, sir.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages, or you can tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So, Tim, give us a very quick background of what began this process, why we're here.
Well, Mark, the Maryland is along with all the other Chesapeake Bay states, is essentially working to restore water quality in Chesapeake Bay, and it's suffering from nutrient pollution. You all have heard this many times before, but it's essentially nitrogen and phosphorus, and it's coming from all sources within the watershed. Agriculture happens to be, according to the Environmental Protection Agency, the probably the largest single source of nutrient and sediment pollution to the bay. And so this phosphorus management tool was designed as an attempt to deal with one of the aspects of that agricultural pollution, the runoff from and seepage from farm fields of phosphorus in this particular case. It turns out that manure, chicken litter that's used as fertilizer is relatively high in phosphorus, or it carries more phosphorus than the crops generally need, and it has been building up in the soils there. So the attempt here is to try to tighten the limits on how much phosphorus can be put down on the soil and prevent phosphorus from running off into the bay and into its tributaries. There's been progress being made in the bay cleanup, according to the federal and the state authorities. Nitrogen has come down over the past 30-some years. Phosphorus has to a degree, but in the last 10 years at least, the levels of phosphorus actually measured in waterways around the watershed in a significant number of them has plateaued, and in some notably the Chop Tank on the Eastern Shore, which is agriculturally dominated, those levels are going up and have been going up. And so there's a real concern to try to come to address that. And this this tool was meant to essentially put some limits on the amount of phosphorus that could be put on farm fields to fertilize them. And in doing that, it would, you know, the assessment was that it would significantly reduce the amount of chicken litter, poultry waste that could be used as fertilizer.
And just and I understand that in the beginning when this whole thing happened that this was supposed to go into effect, that there was an agreement allegedly in place, and then it was pulled from the table by the governor for further study.
Correct.
Am I right about that?
So, yeah. So there's, you know, sort of a two-year attempt to sort of get this regulation in place. The state had pledged this as part of its, you know, its watershed implementation plan for cleaning up the bay years ago. There was, you know, there was a proposed regulation. It was pulled back for further discussion. There was a group of stakeholders that included some in the ag community and the poultry industry to talk about that. Despite the Department of Agriculture's belief that they had more or less reached agreement with all stakeholders, the industry continued to express concern after it was re-proposed. And so it was pulled for this economic impact study.
And so what I understand is that there's a professor, Memo Dürker, I hope I said his name correctly, from Salisbury University, who was conducting the study, sent it out for peer review, but nobody seemed to be notified it was sent out for peer review, at least by one source that was from DeMarva News. And Phil Davis, and so, but Kevin Anderson, you were there from the beginning and still involved in this process, right?
Yes, sir, I have been.
So let's talk a bit about. I mean, so it was pulled, and so where are you with this now?
We're in limbo with the rest of the state of Maryland, wondering what's happening right now. We in the beginning. You know, the farming community had concerns over this from the beginning, and we aired our concerns with the department. I had a conference with discussion with Secretary Hance over 2 years ago about this issue, and there were some we had some big concerns over the impact to the agriculture community. And really, we felt like those concerns were ignored until we got to the public hearing phase. And when we got to the public hearing phase and the administration and the Department of Agriculture was overwhelmed with attendance at these hearings and people expressing their concerns about the economic impact to their farming operations with a tool that gave us no documentation of any environmental benefit. We kind of felt like that was more than we could, you know, more burden than we could take at the time when we had already met our 2017 water quality guidelines. So the administration agreed to have this economic impact study. Which the ag community believes will show hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of, if not millions of dollars of an economic impact to the shore. And we supplied our facts and figures from our farming operations to Memo, and we were expecting to hear something a month ago, but we're standing in line with the rest of you waiting for the outcome of this survey, which I understand the administration and the Department of Agriculture sees a draft, but they haven't released it to the stakeholders, to the or to the general public.
Mark, if I could, just to update that.
Yeah,
I did,
and then we'll get to Scott, who hasn't had a chance to get in yet. Go ahead. Get him. Tim, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah, just a real quick point. I checked with the Department of Agriculture today on the study and where it stands, and was told that it is in peer review, and they expect it to be finished within a couple of weeks. So we may see it rather shortly.
So, Scott, talk about where you think this is, both politically and otherwise, the importance of what we're wrestling with here.
I think it's hugely important. You know, I think in some regard this is a very simple issue. If you look down on the eastern shore, where ag is very dominant form of an industry, and you look at soil phosphorus saturation rates down there, there is no question that there's simply too much phosphorus on the eastern shore. The Environmental Working Group 2010 report, Bay Out of Balance, if you look at those numbers, counties like Worcester County, Dorchester County, they're at 91 and 89% soil saturation, which means almost all of the soil that's tested is at optimum or above levels for phosphorus. In Somerset County, where Mr. Anderson's farm is, that number's at 86%. So we have a significant phosphorus problem on the eastern shore to a point where you just can't simply keep applying manure and other phosphorus-rich fertilizers on this land anymore. And so in that respect, we're dealing with a simple issue. The bay is being inundated with phosphorus because of saturation rates. And this tool is critically important. It is a way to bring those rates down to stop phosphorus from pouring off these farms and into the bay. And it's needed. It needs to be implemented if the bay stands any chance of coming back. Now, I understand that if you implement this phosphorus tool, that you're force farms to apply manure and other fertilizers in agronomic amounts as it's supposed to be done, so that the plants uptake the phosphorus and there's no more runoff, that's at a cost to industry. But that's what industries have to do to manage their waste. Every industry is expected to manage its waste and to use its revenues in order to manage this waste. But you know, part of the irony here is when I hear this industry talk about, well, we need to look at the cost of implementing proper waste disposal systems, is that you're dealing with an industry that already receives significant amount of money from the government to manage their waste, to implement good conservation practices. Somerset County alone, again, where Mr. Anderson's farm is, in the last 20 years, farms in that county have received almost $18 million in federal funding. That doesn't include state dollars, cover crop programs, and manure transport programs. So we are heavily funding an industry to take care of its waste while industry keeps pushing back and doesn't want to do the things that are common sense that are needed in order to revive the bay. And we think that the PMT needs to be implemented fast. We are not convinced that that's what's going to happen in Maryland. As a matter of fact, the Secretary of Agriculture, Buddy Hance, was reported in the Delmarva Poultry Industries March newsletter saying that the department is, and this is a quote from their newsletter, the department's not in a hurry to get a regulation adopted. They're looking at some phase-in over 3 to 4 year period. So it's not being treated with the urgency it needs to be treated with. It needs to be implemented quickly. The bay, as Tim pointed out, is not getting better when it comes to phosphorus, and some waterways down the eastern shore are actually going in reverse and getting worse.
So we have to take a quick break here. I'm going to come right back. I'm going to go right to Kevin Anderson and kind of respond to that and talk about the question of if our waters are in bad shape, what should be the response? And the whole question of what Scott was saying about federal state money is invested in, what this might cost farmers, and your perspective on that, Kevin Anderson. We'll be right back. And this very critical discussion on the future of the state of Maryland and the ag industry and our waterways. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here as we wrestle with the question of the phosphorus management tool known as PMT. What do it mean for the state of Maryland, for its waterways, the ag industry, the battle taking place, and no uncertain terms, it is a battle. Tim Wheeler's reported for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog. Scott Edwards is co-director of Food and Water Watch Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. And Kevin Anderson He's president of the Maryland Grain Producers Association and the grain farmer at Wimberley Farms in Princess Anne, Maryland. 410-319-8888 is number here. Please join us with your thoughts. Write to us here at talkstandardshow.org. So, Kevin, let me let you come back here with this. I mean, is it a question that some in the agricultural industry are saying we do not need this tool? Or is the fear more what it's going to cost you? And what about what Scott was saying in terms of the money that's already being put into the farming industry?
Well, I'm not familiar with the $18 million figure that he put out, but I'm sure that involves all of our conservation practices, such as duck ponds for ducks unlimited and other water conservation practices that the federal government are putting on practice in our wetlands and other conservation practices, not dealing with the poultry industry's litter problem or waste problem that he refers to. And also he talks about the phosphorus management tool, which is never – we haven't had this tool in place. We've never used it. No one is picked out the fallacies of it yet. If we could run the tool to find out the impact and to perfect the tool, the ag community would be more comfortable with it. But we have also been told that it would take 50 years to see a reflection in the water quality in the bay if the phosphorus management tool was implemented today. He refers to phosphorus pouring off of our farm fields into the bay and to the tributaries. That is not the case. It will take 50 years to see water quality improvement on that. You know, and Mark, the common sense approaches that we're talking about, this is another case of where the ag community and the environmentalists probably agree on 50 to 60 to 70% of this. But the water quality in Maryland continues to stay at the stage where it's at because we're fighting over the other 30%. And there's nobody that brings the ag community together with the environmentalists and say, we'll argue over this 30% later, but let's get this 70% implemented on the ground today. And that's the sad part, is that it's either we want it all on both sides. And on agriculture has people on the extreme as well as the environmentalists do. But there's no group in the middle that says, let's take the 70% we agree on and run with it and improve the water quality today, and we'll fight about the other 30% that we disagree on later.
So, Tim, let me ask you this question. I mean, the comment on what you just heard about the 70-30%, but B, before we go back to Scott, the question of whether the phosphorus management tool was or wasn't kind of tested, maybe I'm wrong. I thought the science was there before the agreement fell apart. Or am I wrong?
No, the scientist at the University of Maryland didn't even get, he got like 18 months to develop this tool. Josh McGrath only had 18 months to develop this tool. He wanted 3 years. He wasn't granted that.
So
it has been such an uproar with the science community at College Park that the author of this tool, Josh McGrath, has left the University of Maryland and gone to Kentucky.
So let me ask Scott, Tim, and then go to Scott. Tim, what, your thoughts on that history?
I'm not familiar with the 18 months versus the 3 years. This issue of phosphorus buildup in the soils has been known for 15 years or more. I can remember hearing about this in the late 1990s from University of Maryland scientists. So it's been a problem that's been known for a long time, and it was only when the EPA imposed its pollution diet or total maximum daily load that the state really came to grips with this, it would appear. And began to sort of pledge to take some action on it just within the last 3 to 4 years. The issue about the 70-30 is that basically there are other sources of pollution. Granted, there's wastewater, there's sewage spills and sewage overflows, which have a very important effect in local waterways. They're not, you know, in terms of the total load of nutrients going into the bay, runoff is still by far the one of the largest. You know, in Maryland has doubled its fee charged to water and sewer customers and to septic tank owners to deal with the sewage side of things. There is, you know, just beginning a concerted effort to attack the issue of urban stormwater runoff, which has been a growing problem because just of the growing population and development of the watershed. You know, there was the 10 largest communities or counties in the state and the city of Baltimore were required to charge fees on their property owners in order to help pay for this cleanup. These things are starting to move forward. There's some unhappiness about having to pay more, but the intended purpose of those increases in fees and payments is to tackle those other pieces of the pie. And there are things that the farming community are doing as well. Many of them funded by the rest of us taxpayers through government funds. The farmers are planting an awful lot of cover crops to soak up the excess nitrogen in the soil and to keep it in place so it doesn't run off as much. Record levels of sign-up for cover crops this year, I understand. That money is, you know, those cover crops are basically paid for by the state of Maryland, by taxpayers. So we are, you know, ponying up here. The farmers are cooperating. They are doing the planting, and they're you know, contributing a share of the cost in doing a lot of this conservation work. But this issue of the soil buildup of phosphorus has been one that's been that is out there. It's going to take a long time to fix, but it at some point one has to start.
So I mean, the crux of this thing seems to be. Scott Edwards, and then we'll go, Kevin and Scott can go back at it here with a minute in the last 7 or 8 minutes we have left. But, I mean, it seems that the bottom line here is, A, who pays for the cleanup of the bay? Who should be paying for the cleanup of the bay? Will this PMT actually do that job, Scott Edwards? And then what happens economically to the agricultural community? That's part of the debate as well. So jump into that.
Yeah, so to your second question first, will the PMT achieve a clean bay? Mr. Anderson is right. It's going to take decades before we achieve that, even if you were to implement the PMT tomorrow, because of the significant saturation rates that now exist on the Eastern Shore. And it will take time. If you make this adjustment now, for those rates to begin to drop and the runoff begins to drop. But as Tim said, this is not the jury's in. Industries love to say that the science is still out of the jury. We saw that from the tobacco industry. We see that from the fracking. We see that from every industry. The jury's not out on whether there's too much phosphorus being dumped on the ground down on the Eastern Shore. It is happening. There is no question, and the science behind the PMT is sound science, and it's just plain logic. It is, you've got too much phosphorus. You have to reduce those things. Who should? And again, it is going to be an economic burden on industry, as taking care of its waste should be an economic burden. The people who are not footing that economic burden, though, who should be contributing, are some of these big poultry companies who produce massive amounts of manure down the Eastern Shore, more than that area. You've got a very fragile peninsula of a small area of land jutting out into a nutrient-impaired waterway. It cannot take the amounts, the mountains of manure that are being produced down there. And so you've got to get these big companies to contribute, just as every citizen, through paying flush tax and paying sewer fees and paying stormwater fees. Everybody contributes to the cleanup of the bay except these big companies. And, you know, that's why we supported the Poultry Fair Share Act last year in the legislature, and we'll do it again this year to try to get some of these companies to contribute to the bay cleanup. If you know, this whole 70-30 issue, yes, every source of pollution needs to be addressed. Absolutely right. And Mr. Anderson's right. You need to go after stormwater runoff and municipalities and industrial sources and wastewater treatment plants. But the 70-30 can't be 100% of those sources and 0% of the ag industry. You also have to clean up ag. If I can't promise you that if you clean up all those other sources of pollution that you'll have a clean bay. But what we can say, given ag's contribution, is that if you don't force agriculture to make significant changes in their contributions, you will never have a clean bay, because they are the largest source of nutrients, and they continue to be the largest source of nutrients despite all the efforts, despite all the money and the conservation money that's been poured into this industry. They are still the most significant source of nutrients in the bay, and it will never be clean until we address that.
So, I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, this gets into who should pay for this. Kevin, I'm curious, before we have like 5 minutes left, so...
No problem. So, one question there I think was misinterpreted when I said 70% of the PMP, I think the agriculture community agrees with. I mean, 70% of this tool that we're arguing about and spent 2 years arguing over, we could have implemented 70% of that 18 months ago. But because we were arguing over particulars that narrow it down, that put people's farms and livelihoods at the risk of going out of business and going broke, has caused us to get this far. I would say 70% of the PMC, the agriculture community, can sit down to a table and agree to in a format that everybody can live with. And that's what I see about it. Who should pay for this? Everybody. You know, when I was in college in the mid-'80s, we were encouraged to put phosphorus in our soils. It was called banking our nutrients. The economic community told us, that encouraged us to pour more phosphorus on our soils than we needed, because it wasn't going anywhere. So that's how the problem happened, because we were doing what we were told from scientists. In the early 90s, the scientists said, whoa, hold on a minute. We may have a problem brewing here. We need to change our practices. So we've been 10 or 15 years in our practices, but the water, the phosphorus flow that is coming from the groundwater into the tributaries of the bay are from what we did in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s.
So I'm sorry to interrupt, we're almost out of time here, but Tim Wheeler, no matter where it came from in the past, clearly the question is what to do about it now. So where do you think this goes politically? What's going to happen next?
Well, it's if this report comes out in the next couple of weeks, then it will clearly fall into the lap of the O'Malley administration to decide how to proceed, assuming that it does find that there's a very significant economic impact on farmers and on the poultry industry. And by all reports, the poultry industry operates with a pretty narrow profit margin. There's a challenge here. The State Department of Agriculture has said that their latest statements, as I think Scott referenced, were that they were looking to phase this in over a period of 2 to 4 years, something like that. They were also proposing ways of dealing with the waste that would actually use, again, taxpayer money and some industry money to transport the poultry litter off the Delmarva Peninsula to other places where it could be used more appropriately and not cause runoff. There's been exploration of and a contract awarded to a facility that would actually burn or process the waste to generate electricity. That doesn't seem to be going anywhere very fast, though. So there is a challenge here to sort of how to address the transition here, because it will undoubtedly cost farmers who can't use poultry litter more money to buy chemical fertilizer, and it will cost them to dispose of this stuff if they can't find some safe place to put it. So that's a big challenge. Of course, we're having an election in November, and whatever the O'Malley administration decides will ultimately have to be implemented by
whoever's next. So it's literally out of time. 30 seconds. Scott, we haven't heard. Let you close out in the 30 seconds we have. Literally, so 30 seconds.
Yeah. There are lots of solutions that are being raised right now, and most of them are Band-Aids. The big problem is you've got an unsustainable industry producing unsustainable amounts of manure. And until we get to the root of that problem and put the responsibility where it lies, we can continue to use the Band-Aids, but the problem is not going to get any better. It hasn't gotten better in the last 20 years, and it's going to continue to go downhill.
Well, we will continue this conversation with the guests you've been hearing here on the air right now and others as we look at this. This is very critical to the future. We'll see where it goes. In a few weeks, the PMT analysis will be out. We'll be focusing on this in December. We'll be focusing on this for our Annapolis Summit with the governor, the speaker, and this president's Senate, and during the course of the session. Excuse me. We have been joined by Scott Edwards, co-director of Food and Water Watch Justice Project at Food and Water Watch, Kevin Anderson, who is president of the Maryland Grain Producers Association and himself a grain farmer from Wimberley Farms in Princess Anne, Maryland, Tim Wheeler, who's a reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog. Thank the three of you so much for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites.
Thanks, Mark. Feel better.
Thank you all.
Thank you both. Thank you. Thanks, Scott. In brief break, we're going to come right back and look at a remarkable film festival coming to Maryland. Stay with us.
Been living with a fugitive inside of us, like Buffalo Wild under a buffalo sun, running in a closing in maddened world, racing against the predators of spirit, in facing off with progress's addictions, civilized destruction's wanting habits, polite or violent, whatever it takes, with guns and laws and truth that lies. Domesticating the natural for harvest, threatened by what nature made free, with civilized rational aggressions wreaking blood havoc.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back here to the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites. And you just heard from a really remarkable little film called Buffalo Wild, which is based around a poem by the great Native American poet and thinker John Trudell, that we be part of this Chesapeake Wild and Scenic Film Festival coming up that we're about to talk about here with our guests. We are joined by David Flores, who is a Baltimore Harbor waterkeeper for Blue Water Baltimore, and Ellen Roach is with us, who is one of the producers of the Story of Solutions from Free Range Studios, and Free Range Studios Director of Brand Strategy. And I think we'll have other guests here in a moment as soon as I see who they are. Welcome, David and Ellen. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. I want you to describe this film, Story of Solutions, in just a moment. But maybe, David, you can begin by kind of describing what this whole festival is about.
Yeah, this festival is a fundraiser for the organization Waterkeepers Chesapeake, which is a organization that coordinates 18 different distinct waterkeeper organizations in the Chesapeake region. So we have 18 different waterkeeper organizations in Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. And several years ago, we got together understanding that there were some regional and statewide issues that we needed to advocate around and created Waterkeepers Chesapeake to help us coordinate our efforts to address things like agricultural pollution and municipal stormwater pollution, and then also more particularized issues like the Conowingo Dam and the Cove Point LNG export terminal.
So, and Ellen, there are a lot of films here, and I just highlighted that one coming into the program, which is a lovely little film. But talk a bit about what you're bringing to the festival, The Story of Solutions.
Sure. So Free Range is a branding and creative marketing firm, and so we work with visionary clients who are out to change the world, and we create stories that help them do that. So Annie Leonard came to us 7 years ago, and she was basically a garbage expert. She had traveled all over the world. She had looked at how our stuff was produced, how we use it, how it was thrown away. And, she wanted to take some time with her family and stop traveling. And she came to us and said, let's make this a video. And, of course, we know that, like, the outer limit of successful videos online is 3 to 5 minutes. So we said, well, you've got an hour worth of content. Can we do this in 3 minutes? She said, well, I think I could do it in 20. So that was 7 years ago. That 20-minute film ended up going massively viral. It's the story of Steph. The Story of Solutions is the latest episode in that series, and we've moved from looking at issues like cosmetics, electronics, the story of cap and trade, to really going for what can we do in terms of solutions. And I think to kind of reference the previous conversation, we're looking here for root cause solutions, not for Band-Aids.
And so in terms of this festival, what's the importance of this festival to all that for you?
Well, I think the message of the film is really that, you know, there are no silver bullet solutions to these complex problems, and clicking and watching movies is great, but it's not enough. So what I love about doing actual in-person film festivals is that people can have real conversations, create new connections, and start the kind of solutions building that has to happen locally.
And let me welcome Robin Broder to the program, who is a Waterkeeper Chesapeake board member. Good to have you with us, Robin.
Hi, thank you. Sorry, I got a little disconnected right at the beginning.
Listen to me. I've been disconnected a lot in my life. It's fine. It's not to worry about it. So talk a bit about the question I was asking Ellen, who's bringing this. Really, I know Story of Solutions is incredible work. is it that whole series? I'm glad it's coming to this festival. But talk about the importance of this festival and also where it's taking place.
Right. Well, the Wild and Scenic Film Festival began several years ago with an organization out west called the South Yuba River Citizens League, and they packaged together environmental films that groups like ours, Waterkeepers Chesapeake, and many other nonprofits can use as an event. And we've packaged together some of their more films that are related to water issues, and they're very inspiring and educational, and show the adventure of being out on the water as well. And we end the festival with some films such as The Story of Solutions that talk about solutions. So we it's a great opportunity to bring together folks in the community to meet our organization, Waterkeepers Chesapeake, and the local waterkeepers that will be at the event, and become inspired by the films. And also inspired by the location. We're going to have the event this Thursday evening, October 2nd. It starts at 6:30, and it's at the Annapolis Maritime Museum, which is in the East Port section of Annapolis, right on the water. It's a wonderful little museum dedicated to the history of the oyster industry on the bay. And they have a very nice facility for us to show these films and to introduce ourselves to the community as well. As David mentioned earlier, the coalition has been around for a while, but recently we have formed into a 501c3 and hired a great executive director, Betsy Nicholas, and we have a wonderful website now, and this is our first event, so we hope to see a lot of folks from around the Bay and Annapolis on Thursday evening.
No, it sounds really great, and there's a whole lot going on. There's more happening in January as well, and you're going to have films there like Blackfish and Gasland 2.
Well, we're right? having a film on fracking issues called Backyard, and one that's set in South Africa as well. We're having a couple of films related to some international water keepers. One is fighting for the Afutalafu, which is in Chile, and a small short film on Iraqi marshlands and bringing back the marshlands in Iraq. We have some stuff closer to home on the southern Appalachia and Cove Point, which is in the news now that that was authorized yesterday. And as David mentioned, that's a large regional campaign issue that we're working on.
Ellen, I'm going to come back to you because I think that what's really critically important here is the role of film and short media in getting to people. I think you made a really important point about 20-minute films. I heard Robert Redford once say that he's only interested now in making movies that are about 20 minutes long, maybe a half an hour at most, that can fit on your iPhone. The world is changing.
Yeah, and what I find really fascinating kind of day-to-day at my job is that even though we are so saturated with media, that film can inspire a lot of emotional connection immediately. I was preparing for a presentation the other day, and I was going to use a film as an example in the presentation. I've seen this film. It's actually it's an ad, and I've seen it a dozen times, and I watched it just to prep for this presentation. I watched it twice, and I cried both times. So for me, that is the power of film, that It's immediate, it's visceral, it creates this great empathetic connection, and it can help move people really quickly on issues that they don't know a whole lot about. Obviously, it can take really big, complex issues and simplify them, so it's amazing. I do want to reiterate the point that it's not, you know, the be-all, end-all, that films can inspire, but we have to actually create the solutions that we want.
So I want to encourage everybody, if they can make this, please go to this film festival. It's going to be amazing. Learn about the Wild and Scenic Film Festival coming to Annapolis Maritime Museum this Thursday, October the 2nd, from 6:30 to 9:45 p.m. at waterkeeperschesapeake.org or wildandscenicfilmfestival.org. And do not want to miss this. Conversations will be great. The films will be great. The people you'll meet there will be fascinating. And Robin Broder, David Flores, and Ellen Roach, thank you three so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
You too. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Delmarva Pop Radio is Christopher Rank. Our intern is Sianna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews, A Clean Cut. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast now on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.